Welcome to Stepping Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms not only within the system, but within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon.
Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and I'm really excited to have as my guest today Derek Bell. Derek Bell is an internationally recognized legal scholar, civil rights activist, and writer. He currently teaches at New York University School of Law and is the author of 7 books, including the New York Times bestseller, Faces at the Bottom of the Well. And I read that book, Derek Bell, and that's why when I heard that you were in the area here, I just thought, ooh, I want to interview you, because I was very moved by that book, which I read some years ago, but I thought it was very intense and very true. And is the subtitle of that, the permanence of racism?
Racism. Hi, Sue. And it's amazing. That book is 10 years old. And it still sells well. I'm never going to be able to retire to Tahiti with the royalties, but I will. I live in a kind of spiritual Tahiti because of so many people who have found that book worthwhile. I wrote many of their allegorical stories, mainly with my character Geneva Crenshaw, and I wrote many of them to address issues for my law students. I found that people like stories and that they listen to stories and divorce the writer from the story and the characters in the story so that you can get across points about which they are basically resistive because they will be involved in the story. And then you kind of move people forward that way, I think. And so I've been very pleased. I hope my new book, Ethical Ambition, does as well. Mm-hmm. Not on a bestseller list, though that certainly wouldn't be bad. But in terms of a book that will, and the reason I wrote it was to inspire people that what the society tells them is wrong with regard to success and ethical living. That it is possible. You don't have to sacrifice one or the other to reach your professional goals or money goals or what have you. It's simply that you have to, as you pursue the goals that this society almost requires that you pursue, that you keep a determination to maintain your integrity as priority number one. Mm-hmm. Now, that may mean you have to go to the side. It may mean you may not be able to do that direct path that you had planned. But often enough, that sidetracking, that detouring, leads you to a better path. It certainly has for me. It certainly has for many others.
Well, I guess that depends how you define success. We're just talking about these times, and the Homeland Security Act just passed, and we have the Patriot Act. And, of course, there's a lot of political prisoners in the United States. And I want to let people know that you, Derek Bell, have 2 times quit your job, 1 time as a professor at Harvard University, and people don't just easily walk away from Harvard University, and also from the University of Oregon Law School, where you were not pleased with the number or the not hiring of African American or women of color.
Right.
And there
was an Asian woman, and most of our minority students were Asian. I think, Sue, that it's not necessarily evil. It's just that most white men don't recognize the value of models. people of color and women also live in a world in which you're always being put down. You know, you turn on the television and you're playing some subordinate, crazy role. You don't see people like you in the highest offices and all, or very few. And so as part of the educational process, it's very valuable to have people like you who have gone where you would like to go and who hopefully are encouraging you. Now, I thought I could play that role for all people of color, and I certainly tried. But I came to recognize, particularly when we finally got a black woman as a visitor, that no, that women, white women, black women, Asian women, needed something different than what I could provide. And I tried to convince the faculty of that. But of course she, as we hoped she would, stepped on a few toes by telling truths out of school, so to speak. And at the end they did not offer her a tenured position. And it was just this last straw. You don't do these things willy-nilly. You know, you lose this battle, lose that one, you lose that one, and finally you realize it's not going to change. And so I told them I wouldn't return. I'd take leave, unpaid leave, until they got a person of color. And I was on leave 2 years. And they said, oh, you have to come back because we have this rule. Well, I think because they would never leave Harvard. They figured this black guy is not going to leave. But I didn't think I had any alternative but to continue really what is a teaching lesson, you know. And it's amazing. We're talking about taking different paths. I am basically a teacher. They see troublemaker and writer and law professor and whatever, but I'm basically a teacher. And I now run into students from Harvard, and they say, I wish you were still here, but I know why you're not. And because of that action, I've picked up and read some of your writings, and it gives me a lot to think about. Well, Sue, a teacher can't ask for more than that, you know? And so by leaving Harvard, I became a likely more effective teacher. Because how do we teach? The teachers we remember from our youth, we probably can't remember a thing they taught us. We remembered their model. We remembered their encouragement. We remembered their example. And we wanted to emulate them, you see. So that in some degree, I have achieved this while I was challenging in Harvard. I remember when I came home and told my wife what I decided to do. And she was ill at the time and not very happy. But she said, why does it always have to be you? Because she had, you know, we had 7 different mortgages during our 30 years because we kept moving. And she was always fiercely loyal. But this strained her tolerance. But then in our friends called, and I never said, but one guy said, you can't do this. Your wife is really very ill. And I told him I appreciated his call and all. But it seemed to me, I hope not incorrectly, that had I told Jewel, I decided, you know, you're not well, I'm not going to do the protest. That would have been more, given our history, that would have been more painful than if I'd carried on. One last thing. She was in bed, and I was spending the time with her one afternoon, and Bill Cosby called. I don't know whether he wants us on the rip. But he said, man, Camille and I know what you're doing, and we applaud you. And if they try to mess with you up there, we'll put you on our shadow legal staff, and you won't have to miss a financial beat. Well, I said, Bill, I really appreciate your call, and I really did. But I said, I can make it, you know. He later gave me one of the producers called and made me a sort of a assistant writer or something like that, and I gave them some ideas. But it was that support. People don't recognize when you're out there that you don't really need their money. You need their support. You need to offer, hey, I'm with you. I'll watch your back. And that is precisely what you often don't get, you see.
Yeah, I was about to say. I mean, with the kind of the breakdown of community I'll refer to in this country, I don't know how it was before, but it is definitely that is in shorter supply than I wish, at least.
It's what happened to Paul Robeson. Paul Robeson was one of the great men of his time. He was a marvelous talent, an actor, a singer. He'd gone to Columbia Law School. He was, you know, he was a great athlete at Rutgers, and worldwide fame, wealth. And yet, because he spoke out unrelentingly about racial discrimination, it was during the McCarthy era. They took away his passport so he couldn't earn a living overseas, where he was still highly popular. Concert halls here wouldn't lease him space, and he just went down. He never agreed, though, to stop talking about racial discrimination. And so, you know, sometimes your inspiration, despite the defeats that you incur while you're taking what you think is an ethical, moral stand.
Well, it's definitely, I think, does take a lot of courage more than ever right now, and because the risks of going to prison and being disappeared and all these kinds of things that happen in usually in other countries with the United States behind it, but we're not used to happening to a large number of people in this country, although it certainly happens to a few. It's been going on for a while. So to have courage in your book, Ethical Ambition, Living a Life of Meaning and Worth, your chapters are called The Power in Passion. Are these the right? This is the chapters? Mm-hmm. Courage and Risk-Taking, Evolving Faith, Advancing Relationships, Ethical Inspiration, and Humility's Wisdom. So I guess we're here talking about the courage and risk-taking, or you can talk about any of it. But,
you know, my students always ask, you know, I want to be successful, and yet I want to keep my integrity. You seem to have done it. How did you do it? And I would say that I'd been very fortunate, which is true. But I decided that that was not the answer they were looking for. And over time, I tried to identify and isolate, kind of articulate some of the forces, some of the pillars of support. And I think one of them for me, and I think for others, is passion about either your job or your stand, what have you. Because with passion, involvement, that out of that passion can come the willingness to take risks that others won't take, to tell the truth when others who know the truth as well as you do are fearful of what will happen to them if they tell the truth. And out of that risk-taking comes actions that others will deem as courageous. I don't think you ever see yourself as courageous, but I think others who often are unwilling to do what you're doing, when they're not scandalizing your name, which of course also happens, we'll see these actions as courageous. And I just found that was very valuable, that I've always been passionate about my work, about the race issues in this country, and that my stands are hardly adequate to make major changes. But I'm not sure that is our obligation. I think we're put on earth not simply to drive Mercedes and BMWs, although nothing wrong with that, but to recognize bad stuff, injustices, and do something. It may not even be the right thing, but our obligation is to do something, because that's not the test whether it's going to be successful or not, whether it's the right thing or not. It's out of the action itself, out of the stand itself, that to the extent that it's possible for us human beings to have salvation right here, that's how you get it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I study a lot of different traditions and do practices in different spiritual traditions, and it seems like the issue of intention seems to be very important. Intention and love, those mm-hmm. seem to be two constants that people say really makes a difference, no matter what. I don't know, maybe that may be slightly too broad a statement, but I was about to say no matter what you're doing. But anyway, that those two things are really important.
Well, people asked me, he said, well, how about the right-to-lifers who picket and harass women going into abortion? They believe in it. They have a religious passion for it and what have you. And I acknowledge, well, maybe they do. But it would seem to me if they were truly thinking of others, not just these unborn children, but people who are here alive, that, and it, they thought deeply about it. One of the reasons I placed the last chapter, I call the last chapter, humility, because it seems to me that those of us who are passionate about some cause, some position, whatever, have an obligation to be introspective, to self-evaluate frequently, because there's a tendency to become a little self-righteous. During the early part of my career, I worked for the Legal Defense Fund of the NAACP, and I supervised 300 school desegregation cases. So I thought my place in heaven was already reserved. But over the years, I recognized that I hadn't listened to that biblical admonition about serving two masters, that you really can't do it. Either you will serve the one and ignore the other, or vice versa. And I found that I was basically serving my belief that integration could come through school desegregation. My clients' interests, though, were better schools for their kids. You see, whether they didn't care whether they were integrated schools or stuff, they just wanted better, they wanted education. And it took me a long time to come to recognize that. And when, by that time, I was in teaching, and I wrote an article in a Yale Law Journal. It was titled Serving Two Masters. And I think it got out the truth as I understood it, but my old civil rights colleagues excommunicated me for years. You know, they didn't have anything to have, because they were still focused on that thing. I felt I was fortunate to be able to stand back from the day-to-day cases and get this view, but it took years for them to come around, and by that time the opportunity for different strategies had pretty much passed.
Well, what are you thinking now, Derek Bell, about what's going on? Did I just read that they're going to start stopping desegregation some places in the schools? And of course, there's a lot of things that are happening in terms of racism and victories that the small, it seems to me, victories that were won in civil rights were like losing a lot of rights, all of us, and the gap between people of color and white people is growing, and between African Americans and European Americans is just growing between, you know, if you want to look at it as class or race or whatever, the gap is growing. So what do you think about what's going on now?
Well, on the school situation, I think school leaders, many of whom are black, are recognizing what I didn't recognize, and that integration, if you can have it, is wonderful. But often enough, you can't have it. And it's not the law bringing about segregation. It is the ability and willingness and determination of whites to move away that does it. And often under the ability and willingness of blacks of means, of middle class and what have you, to move away as well. So we have these inner cities of poor kids from poor families and, for the most part, poor schools. And efforts are being made to correct that. I don't know with regard to race. I may be so close to it, having worked in one area of race or another for 40 years, 45 years, that I may be too close to it. I think there are things that are happening now that 20 years ago, 30 years ago, I was having dinner last night, this is a small example, with a fellow who went to high school with me. He was a marvelous athlete. He was the quarterback. When he got to college, they didn't want black quarterbacks, so he was a halfback. He was a marvelous halfback. He went to a professional team, and I think they turned him into a defensive back, you know, to chase down the passes and what have you. And he did very well at that. But he had fallen in love with Rochelle, a white woman. And the team owners called him in and said that he'd have to drop that relationship because they just couldn't afford to have that on their team. And he wouldn't do it, and that ended his professional career. Now, if you compare that with the day where it just seems as we see these basketball stars and football stars who are in black and in baseball, that if they don't have a woman who is white, then they're dropped, I think, sometimes. But it's not the happiest kind of change. But there have been a lot of changes. You see, I mean, Martin Luther King's death that brought on the riots, brought on affirmative action. I'm a beneficiary of affirmative action. I didn't get to Harvard because I was the first black in 150 years that was good enough to be there. I got there because I was there at the right time when they finally recognized it was going to be a good idea. So, you know, I tell my students, with regard to the growing gap, I tell my students who are interested in civil rights that the great challenge in the next decade or so is getting white people to see that they suffer as much from racism as do people of color. Now, that may be a tough task because for so many, they're part of their identification with who they are is being white and being able to identify with the George Bushes and all the people on top, the corporate leaders, honest and not so honest. And so it's going to be a challenge, but it's one that many of my white students have already understood, have overcome. So if they can do it, others in the society, it's just going to be a task.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I agree. That sounds good to me. I just have to say that the University of California right up the street here removed affirmative action, which I'm sure you know.
They did, and it's unfortunate, but I agree with people like Lonnie Guinier that affirmative action had its day. I'm a beneficiary. Lonnie was probably a beneficiary until she ran into Bill Clinton, a great liberal. But we need to move on. You see, you can't just we can't afford the luxury of rigidity. So I think now is the time to challenge, not necessarily in court, but through publicity and petitions and what have you, the fact that the reliance placed on standardized tests is a great privileging of the rich. Mm-hmm. If you ever look at those standards, in each percentile, the people from the highest incomes are at the top, the next highest, and this is true not only for the whole population, it's true if you look only at the white kids, if you only look at the black kids, if you only look at the Asians, that those tests measure best the income of your parents. So that you know, that is a far more, that's as effective as saying no blacks allowed. And so those are, the legacy admits the fact that if you are the child of an alumnus of this, that your chances of getting in are a heck of a lot better than people who have much better scores than you do. Mm-hmm. So I think that the affirmative, the first, you know, so much of the society feels affirmative action is one of the great evils of our time. And if you had if you had a national referendum as to what was the greater danger, the growing gap in the wealth, which is a growing a real danger, or affirmative action, I think an awful lot of Americans would think affirmative action was the more dangerous thing. So that I think we should certainly encourage those who have such programs. But when they're challenged as they are, I would say, number one, let's remove any mention of race from the app. You don't need race. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to let in anybody in that class you want to let in and not use race. And second, we need to start challenging some of these other entrenched traditional admissions criteria or hiring criteria.
Right. Well, I like to point out that there's really no such thing as race, in fact. I mean, it's definitely an intellectual concept. There certainly is racism, which has made this this concept for which
it makes it real, yeah. You see. So that I guess I'm not excited about taking race out of the census or not having it on the applications or whatever, because as long as we have racism, which is not always evil people, it is a part of our society that helps provide stability by having white people who think that they are better because they look like the people on top and are willing to disidentify with the people on the bottom. Affirmative action. The fact is that white people, particularly white women, were greater beneficiaries of affirmative action than were blacks, you see. And even white men, to the extent that it eased the old boy network about how you got hired. You have to advertise those positions now. When I was dean at Oregon, we advertised. We would get 300 applications for one position, and most of them would come from white men who, but for those advertisements, would never have known about the job. you see.
Oh, well, that's a good side effect there. Well, now one of the kinds of racism that's the most, and that overlaps certainly with other racism, is against, well, I don't know if it's the most, but it's pretty intense, is against Arabs, Muslims, anybody who could possibly maybe be. And, of course, there's a lot of African-Americans who are Muslims and a lot of people who look all kinds of... I mean, anyway, it's anybody with darker skin, when, in fact, a lot of Muslims have white skin. I mean, it just shows the absurdity of it all, but it may be absurd, but it's certainly, getting people locked up.
No, I've been in Canada a couple of times on this book tour in Halifax and then more recently in Vancouver, and there's great upset there. The government officials have urged Canadians coming from any of those Middle Eastern countries, even though they hold Canadian citizenship as well, to think twice before they come to America. But because there have been incidents in which individuals have traveled from Canada to Persia, for example, in this one instance, and came back or stopped at JFK, where they were changing planes to go back home to Montreal, and were held for days of questioning, and finally deported not to Canada, but to Syria, where this man had not been since he was a teenager. He, 2 months later, is still in some place where his family can't get in touch with him. Some Canadian officials have been able to get. So we really face some very serious dangers that test not only our ethical beliefs, but test our the basic democratic standards on which this country is supposed to be built.
Well, that's for sure. And your book, Derek Bell, Ethical Ambition, Living a Life of Meaning and Worth, would be a good one to read at this time, well, since we need to take a stand.
Yeah. It's aimed more at the individual than at the corporate giants, at the political bigwigs.
Oh, yeah, I wasn't thinking that. Yeah, I meant...
But I think individuals will need the strength and hopefully the inspiration it provides in order to face up or confront on in their lives the kind of overriding idea that unless you are with us, you're unpatriotic, you're un-American.
And this book can be found all around, I would imagine.
I certainly hope so.
Yeah. So again, the name is Ethical Ambition, Living a Life of Meaning and Worth. And my guest has been Derek Bell, the author. And thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Sue. I appreciated talking to you.
My name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening. Mm-hmm.